So, eating food sacrificed to idols. Come on, surely this is one passage we could afford to skip, isn't it? Think about it. When was the last time you really wrestled over whether it was right or wrong to eat the food in front of you because it had been sacrificed to an idol? I mean, I'm just guessing. I'm going to suggest it's highly unlikely that any of you have had your conscience twinged this week because of this issue of food sacrificed to idols. And then even in the first century, was it really that significant an issue? How many people, even in the first century, would come across food that was sacrificed to idols? So what on earth is going on that would warrant Paul making such a corrective response to the church at Corinth? Well, I'm going to suggest it is the most natural thing in the world to think that way because we tend to interpret Scripture through the lens of our own culture. So what I want to do this morning is first understand what the culture of the time was, what was taking place, see what that significance really had, and then see what lessons there are to learn. And there are real lessons to learn for us today. So let's think about our own culture. Let's just assume you want to choose somewhere to go for a meal. Where would you go? Would you go to the local chippy and eat your fish and chips in a bag in front of you on the street? There you go. Good. Well, I'm glad that you do that, and I know Michael would as well. So that's some people's options. Some might like to go into a cafe. You may think, no, I prefer Italian. I like to sit down in a pizzeria. Maybe you'd like a Greek taverna. Perhaps you'd be into Spanish tapas bars. Maybe you choose Japanese sushi bars. Or perhaps you'd go for the haute cuisine. American food. McDonald's, Burger King. Maybe not. But whichever you do, you probably would go to a dedicated building for that purpose, a restaurant. But you know what? Today, there are now so many options. We have so many opportunities to eat. We can eat in a whole range of different places. You could eat in a garden center. I did yesterday. You could eat in a museum. If you go to Mersey Island, you can meet in a company shed. And if you go into a wedding, you could eat in a castle, in a fort, in an abbey, probably in a disused church somewhere. Am I right that you used to be able to eat in the rotating part of the post office tower as was? I thought I had that distant memory. I've never been there. You can certainly eat almost at the top of the Shard, tallest building in Britain. The opportunities to eat in all of these different places. But it didn't used to be like that, not in this country. It used to be quite a luxury for people to go out and go to the Little Chef. In the 1960s, believe it or not, one of the special evenings out was for people to go to a motorway service caff, where you would actually sit down and there'd be a tablecloth in front of you. And silver, knife and fork, candelabras and the likes, glass of wine. But we don't think of that because culture has moved on. That's what it was like for us today. And so we can't struggle to think back even 30, 40 years. Well, what few people recognize is that in first century ancient world, temples were the restaurants. In the Greek-Roman world, in every major town or city, and Corinth was a major city, they would have their own temples, they would have their own shrines to idols, to deities, to their gods and goddesses, Venus and Apollo and the like, and they would go and celebrate by making a sacrifice to these people. And at feast times in particular, but also at other occasions, people would bring animals for sacrifice. So they'd come to the temple, the animal would be killed, it would be burnt, it would be cooked. And yes, some of it would remain as a burnt offering. Some would go to attendants, but much of it would go to the people who had brought it. They'd eat it themselves. And so as a consequence, groups went. So the guilds, the business guilds of the day, the trade guilds, the clubs, private groups would also go along and they would eat, and crucially, they'd eat some of that meat themselves. So temples were actually acting as a bit of a banquet hall. And they also acted as a butcher shop. And that wasn't the end of the story. Even more, they often couldn't get through all the meat that had been brought, so other people would come and they would share the meat that was available for this feast. And even that didn't get rid of it all, so some would be made available to the marketplace. It has been suggested that most of the meat that was offered for sale in Corinth had actually been offered in sacrifice. So suddenly we see, actually, the Christians in this time had huge opportunities to eat meat that was sacrificed. Do you see how crucial it is that when we're reading Scripture, we understand the context in which it is written? Now, if you've been here for the last two studies in which we've been looking at chapter 7, you'll know that Paul has spent the first six chapters speaking into some appalling behavior that was taking place in this newfound church and giving him guidance. But from chapter 7 onwards, he's addressing issues that they have raised in a letter that they've written to him. And so here in this chapter, food that's been sacrificed to idols is the issue that they have raised. He really shouldn't speed. But Paul doesn't make a simple reading, a guidance on this. He doesn't just say, yes, no, it's right, it's not right to take this food. He does much more than that. Instead, he recognizes that behind the query that they're writing to him about, there's something else going on. There's something actually much deeper. And believe it or not, it takes him three chapters of this letter to answer this question on food. So much for us saying, oh, we can brush that one off, it's not relevant. Three chapters. And as he goes through it, what Paul is doing is, one, he's going to get them to reassess their theology, their understanding of how this relates to God. But secondly, and crucially, he's going to get them to reassess how they relate and behave to one another. And because that is the key that he sees as underlying this, he's going to start by talking about their attitude to one another. It seems that what has happened is he's had this letter in which they'd claimed that because they have got the Holy Spirit within them, this gift of God, so they now have knowledge. That's the word that comes up again and again in this passage. They've got knowledge, wisdom. They now know. And as a consequence of this, they are so confident that it is actually fine to eat meat that's been sacrificed to idols, that they want to impose that view on everybody else. And as we look at this, we, along with Paul, can recognize a bit of arrogance going on here. Very confident. And if you think back, those of you who are here as we've looked at the earlier chapters of this book, will recognize that that boasting, that self-confidence, was an issue that came up again and again, and Paul has had to write to them about it. He's come up in three simple ways. They were so confident, so boastful about who they are as people with this now newfound knowledge, that they were giving credit to the way certain individuals were speaking instead of giving God the credit. So personality cults had been established. Then not only that, they'd become so confident that they thought they were almost above the law. So they're making decisions, appalling decisions, about what was right and wrong. And then they were having lawsuits. In public, they were having lawsuits against their fellow brothers and sisters because they were so confident of their ability to argue. so much for their reasoning skills, so much for this so-called knowledge. And that's what Paul is observing yet again in this passage. Because they think they've got knowledge, they feel they should impose this on everybody else. And Paul says to them, hang on a second. No, just think about it. He says, our faith is not one where we simply accumulate knowledge, like some kind of possession that you wear as a kind of badge of honor that you can then boast about how much you know to other people. That's not the purpose of it. He's saying the point of becoming mature in your faith is to learn how better to demonstrate love to people who don't have that understanding. It comes down to our attitude and the use that we make of the knowledge that we have made available to us. Now, you've heard the phrase, knowledge is power. Yeah, you've heard that phrase used, haven't you? There was a certain US president that used it several times. Knowledge is power. It's quite an in phrase at the moment because of the privacy bill that's being discussed. The security services in our country would say, if we have knowledge about what terrorists are doing, we will have the power to do something about it. Knowledge is power. The opposite is being said about those who are trying to protect privacy and say, yeah, and the more information and knowledge the government has, the more they will use that to control us. Knowledge is power. Well, actually, the first documented use of this phrase comes in the 10th century. And it comes from a Shiite imam. And he said this, knowledge is power and it can command obedience. That's not exactly the sort of attitude that should be ours as God's people, is it? If your attitude towards other people is to dominate them, then knowledge allows you to do that. It allows you to manipulate, to undermine, but also in the process, it gives us such self-confidence because of what we think we know. As a consequence, it leads to pride, it leads to arrogance. And that's what Paul is observing. Quiz question. You're talking to someone who works in London. And as you talk to them, they tell you that in order to qualify for their particular career, they had to do the knowledge. What's their job? And that's why you love the quizzes. Absolutely. Doing the knowledge is what is called for someone to be trained to qualify to be a black cab taxi driver in London. And what that means by the knowledge is you got to know your A to Z inside out, back to front. You need to know what's going on. I was at university with someone who did the knowledge. And he was hoping that if he didn't do well in his degree, he could always go back and be a cabbie again. And he said it took him 3 years driving around on a motorbike, just learning all the streets. The idea is to know that A to Z, to know every single street, to know where the restaurants are, where the pubs are, where the hotels are, so that you can know the best way to get from A to B. And whatever the traffic, however the traffic changes, you'll know the best route to take. That's the knowledge. Well, here's my tip of the day. My recommendation. If ever you're in a taxi, getting a lift somewhere around London, I strongly recommend you don't argue with him about what is the best way to get from A to B. Because he's done the knowledge and you ain't. So don't argue. You're likely to end up walking the rest of the trip. I worked in British universities for 9 years before I came into ministry. And I know this is just a generalization, but one of the things I observed was this, that when it came to academic experts, they found it incredibly difficult to say, I don't know. Isn't it interesting? It's a pride thing. Even though one of the great definitions of being an expert is that you know more and more about less and less. But we can't say we don't know. Paul observed that that's exactly what we've got here. And because they've got the wrong attitude, their knowledge has led to pride, or as Paul puts it, being puffed up. And the objective of Christian ethics, of becoming mature in the faith, is to benefit, to be an advantage to your brothers and sisters. He says it is love that truly builds up. And Paul says anyone who takes pride in the knowledge that they've got is missing the point. And the one thing they don't have is knowledge of the very heart of God. There's a reason, I believe, why people in the church are often referred to by people outside the church as appearing self-righteous. Because there's a little bit of confidence, a little bit of pride that comes. And we don't always share that information well. Here's a question for you. As you get older, as you learn more and more about God, about Scripture, about its meaning and how we should behave, does it change the way you respond and you relate to other people, to those who have a lesser knowledge than you do? Do we use our theology, our biblical wisdom, as a club on people? Do we make demands of people? Do we expect them to follow our convictions? Do we lecture? Do we judge? Do we condemn? Or do we even just criticize? Or do we share what understanding we have come to gain and share it graciously, with gentleness, with compassion, with love, with humility? The picture I have in my mind is Jesus, and Jesus having that interaction with the woman who was caught in adultery. And everybody had the knowledge, everybody knew that her behavior was not acceptable. But what Jesus did was he addressed first the crowd. With the knowledge they had, they wanted to kill her, to stone her. That's how they wanted to use their knowledge. But Jesus used his to first address the crowd and challenge them to get them to dissipate. And then not to condemn the woman, but to lovingly, gently challenge her to change her ways. What an example. But what about that question about eating food that has been sacrificed to idols? The bottom line is, and Paul actually doesn't spend very much time talking about it in this particular section, he agrees, he affirms with what conclusion the Corinthians have come to. He says, you're absolutely right. Idols do not represent real gods, real lords. And so in that statement in verses 4 to 6, he confirms the truth. And he says there is only one true God from whom all things come, including food. And he goes on and he says, and there's only one true Lord through whom, and this is Jesus, through whom we have our very being. And because of that, the principle is simple. A couple of doves and a side of beef sacrificed to a non-existent God is not going to hurt us. So you can eat them. It's not a big deal. Though, I should say, this is where a little knowledge is rather dangerous. He does make clear later on in chapter 10, he distinguishes between eating such meat bought in the marketplace and the very different situation of eating the same meat within the temple as part of a religious ceremony which would be idolatry. He makes that clear later. But for now, he's basically saying, yeah, meat, that's not an issue. It's protein and fat, and as long as you're sensible, it's not harmful. Don't worry about it. But because you think that this is true doesn't give you the right to insist that people who are not sure in their faith that it's right should also do the same thing. People who've not come to that point in their faith. Let me explain. The church in Corinth has only existed for 2 or 3 years since Paul himself established it. They haven't had time to embed within this theological understanding. But even more, many of the Christians, the new converts, are still getting away from the culture for which all of that idolatry stuff was as normal as fish and chips and the BBC is for us. They're still trying to get away from it. And for many of those recent converts, worshipping at shrines and temples and idols has been their routine. Idols and lords have very much been a part of this former way of life, so much so that it's intertwined, if you like, into their consciousness and their emotions, and it still has a hold of them. Let me give you an example. When I worked out in Africa, it was a real eye-opener just how much spiritualism, witchcraft, and superstition had a hold on all cultures, and it still had an impact on Christian cultures. So there's one couple I knew of who were committed Christians, knew their Bible, were leaders in their church. But when an issue came up and people started to dig a little bit further and were wondering why there was such a problem with them, it became apparent they were struggling to get away from this witchcraft side of things. And they had buried little trinkets, little effigies or whatever, under the floor, because they couldn't quite do without the insurance policy that came with the witchcraft that everyone in the village supported. It's a big problem. And you might laugh at that, and you might say, that's ridiculous, they should have known better. Well, here's a bit of a challenge to you. I wonder how many Christians struggle not to, if you like, consult the astrology pages and take notice of them. I wonder how many Christians would go out of the way not to walk underneath a ladder for fear of bad luck, tremble when a mirror breaks, or be throwing salt over the shoulder, and all the superstition that we know should have no relevance in our lives, but how we struggle with that stuff. And so Paul says, look, for those who are young in the faith, those who are struggling to get away from this old life, when they see you in all of your confidence sitting down and tucking into a meal that has been sacrificed to idols, you might just be an enormous stumbling block in their faith. Just imagine, this person, all of their life has been going along to the temple. They've been seeing idols. They've been taking food and drink and sacrificing it to idols and to lords. And of course, maybe the drink has taken over a little bit. Moral constraint has gone out of the window. Maybe they take advantage of the boys and girls that are provided for entertainment, as long as you pay a little more to the gods. But that's supposed to be part of their life they've left behind. And now they see you and you're sitting there and you appear to be tucking into this meal and it seems all right. You can imagine the reminders of all of those images come back, the smells, and then the drink, and they're drawn back into it. The prostitutes are waiting, and suddenly this immature convert who's not been able to move forward is being tripped up because you're so confident of your position before God. You know, when Christ died on the cross, he did so to bring freedom. Freedom from rules and regulations. Of course he did. But Christian freedom doesn't mean that we get to do as we please. Freedom is tied to responsibility not to mislead young Christians who are less than sure about what is right and wrong. Now for us, today, of course, food is not going to be the issue. But I want to suggest to you there are things that could well be a real issue and a real stumbling block. where we can be just as damaging to someone young in the faith if we choose and insist on exercising our right to the freedom God has given to us. Alcohol. Before some of you panic, alcohol in itself is not a problem. It is not something from the devil. It is not a problem. It is not sinful to drink alcohol. Historically, of course, it's what most people drank. Because when water was not refrigerated, it was hard to stop it being contaminated. The natural choice for everybody was an alcoholic drink. But again, if I go back to my time in Africa, I learned a lesson out there. In Africa, alcohol is a massive problem. It is an enormous problem, and alcoholism is an issue all over the continent. And as a consequence, I realized when I was out there that many Christians in Africa choose not to drink at all. And they want to do that to ensure that they don't send the wrong signal. Because for a young convert today, and it could be true in Africa, it could be true in this country as well, if it is the case that alcohol was a part of their old life, perhaps a damaging part of their old life, well, the question is this: would you be prepared to give up what is your right, a freedom, which is to drink alcohol, for the sake of not being a stumbling block to someone who's new to the faith? That's the sort of challenge I'm thinking about. Another one, relationships. Relationships are not bad either. We've done that over the last few weeks, you should know that. What about a Christian couple who are not yet married, but are going to go away on holiday together? They're attached, but they're not actually married. Is there a problem with that? It's certainly not illegal. It is not sinful to go away with somebody, so relax, it's not an issue. Of course. And especially if you know the boundaries which state that any rumpy-pumpy, for want of a better phrase, probably shouldn't have said that, between Christians or between anybody who is not actually married is actually fornication, and that is sinful. But you're going to go away, and it's not a problem because you know where the boundaries are, so there's no issue for you. What if a young Christian, one who doesn't understand those same boundaries, they see your actions in exercising your rights? What if they see you, and that becomes a stumbling block, which undermines their future relationships and may actually cause them to commit adultery later in life? What damage can be done if we are insensitive, even though we know we're not in the wrong in the process? Attendance on Sundays. Come on, no one's going to shoot you if you don't come one Sunday. Of course not. You are free. You don't have to be here. We are not being legalistic about this. That's not the issue. So you know you have freedom and a right that you don't have to be here every time. But here's my challenge. If you are observed by a young Christian who is used to this day, Sunday, being just the same as every other day, no difference whatsoever, by you being quite relaxed about it, it is possible for them to establish their Christian walk being equally lax, and in the process, much more crucially, failing to give a day of the week which is a Sabbath. And in case you think that's not a big deal, it is the fourth commandment. And in God's eyes is just as serious as thou shalt not kill. I just throw these things out because these are difficult issues, aren't they? Challenging. You know the freedom you've got, but we need to learn this lesson and be careful in our behavior. So I'll summarize all of that four very quick conclusions. One, don't get confused. This is not an issue of offending somebody in the church who has a different view from you. That's not what this is about. It has to do with whatever conduct another person could emulate to their detriment. That's the first, the issue. Second, we should be careful when we are arguing for behavior on the basis of knowledge and asserting our rights to the detriment of other people. And Paul will speak about all of this next time, chapter 9. Third, we should live in harmony, and we shouldn't demand a particular behavior from others. And finally, personal behavior shouldn't be determined by knowledge or freedom or the law. It should primarily be determined by love that we show because of what we've come to understand. Love for others and a desire to build other people up. This is a really important passage. I want to challenge us to ask that God would just help us to see that we are more sensitive in how we use our freedoms so that we don't become a stumbling block to others.